Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of real entrepreneurs who are looking for insights and excitement from the stories of people who built phenomenal companies, not just average, not just okay companies, but phenomenal companies. Joining me today is an entrepreneur who saw mobile happening back when most people just didn't fully get how far advanced it was going to be. And he's nodding in agreement, nodding in satisfaction. Am I right?
That's good.
Yeah. But it still was super painful to be that prescient, to see into the future. His name is Arish Ali. He is the founder of Skava. They make a versatile e-commerce platform for retailers. They're being used by companies like Kohl's, by companies like Barnes & Noble to sell online. He launched it, suffered through it. He built it. He succeeded. He sold it. And then... Well, we're going to find out how that happened. This interview, boy, it was a big sale too. This interview is sponsored by two phenomenal companies. The first will host your website, right? And I'm going to tell you this painful story that happened just today. And we'll explain to you why you need to work with HostGator for hosting. And the second is the company that will help you find your next phenomenal developer. I have a feeling that Arish is going to end up being one of their customers by the time this interview is over. But I'll tell everyone, including you, Arish, about them later. First, Arish, good to have you here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me here.
Do you remember how much did you sell to Infosys for? How much money?
$120 million.
$120 million. And how much funding did you take to get to that point?
Zero.
$0. Wow. And the company was founded when?
2002.
So really, you were ahead of the curve on mobile way, way, way before the rest of us had mobile devices and were doing any kind of shopping on the phone.
That's correct. I call it the Stone Age of mobile.
Yeah.
And so we were building mobile apps and mobile platforms in 2002, all the way till kind of before there was iPhone and Android operating systems.
And the iPhone was launched when? 2007, 2008, I think that was the App Store.
Yeah, exactly right. So 2007, 2008, kind of started taking off. So we were kind of building apps on multiple devices, very fragmented ecosystems. There wasn't real kind of big enough market for mobile at that point. I only remember, you know, one exit in that space, a company called Jandak that IPO'd, got acquired by EA, became EA Mobile. It was one real kind of mobile player that made it big. Most of the companies in that space kind of died away or kind of just went away or became like a smaller shop somewhere else. We kind of survived through that rough era. So as it being, when you're early in a space, that's, unfortunately, that's what you have to live through. Very hard to make money in the space. So we managed to kind of get bootstrap, get some kind of money coming in through building games and apps and putting them on any app store we could.
I found a dummy thing that you built. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But why don't we start with the exciting period? Do you remember the day that the sale was announced?
Oh, absolutely.
So what happened that day? How did you find it? Bring me to that excitement and then we'll see how you got there.
Yeah, so that kind of, obviously there's a whole process that goes into selling a company, and that happened through many kind of years and then months before that, and hectic kind of closing the deal takes a lot of time. I flew to Bangalore. I was there for one very frenetic week where I hardly slept for a whole weekend stretch, kind of ironing out all the details. And then finally, when kind of our acquired Infosys, they had a board meeting kind of and approved that this was official. I was in a taxi at that time, going to take a flight to meet my team in Coimbatore, where they're located. And that's when I found out that this official is public, it's all done. So it was an amazing kind of feeling for me. Kind of flew down to Coimbatore, met my team, kind of announced to them as well that as of today, they were all part of a much bigger kind of thing. We've reached a kind of a next stage of our evolution as a company.
I hear a lot of entrepreneurs, they're like, I know myself, go to sleep at night worrying what's going to happen tomorrow. The whole world could change, it feels like, or some competitor can come and knock you out. I wonder if at that point, when you finally had that sale, were you able to just breathe out and go, okay, things are going to be fine now. Did you feel that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a big kind of weight off your head, if you will, because yeah. We have built a successful company, and we were kind of, an oddity in Silicon Valley, I would say. We had actually built a profitable company, and we had bootstrapped it, and we had been stayed very focused on the trade-off we had made was we might grow a bit slower than many other Silicon Valley companies do because they're quick, they take a lot of funding and try to grow very fast.
Yep.
Our mantra has been we wanted to make it to be, it has to be a real business.
And part of the reason is, as I understand it, you work for a company in the dot-com bubble when the bubble burst, right? Which company did you work for there?
A company called Breyence. It was a very heavily funded kind of more in the wireless middleware space. It was a startup, and they had some of the coolest kind of people out there, very smart sort of group of people. And many of them have gone on to start their own kind of fantastic companies afterwards. So it was a great learning experience for me. But this was right around the time of the dot-com crash.
And so how did you feel? How did you experience the dot-com crash? This is like all these companies started to get funding, go public. This is on the heels of Netscape. People were becoming millionaires overnight, getting tons of funding. And then all at once, within a year, it seemed to have all gone away. Talk to me about how you experienced it. Do you remember one day when you thought, oh my goodness, what did I get myself into?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We kind of, my co-founder and I flew down from Seattle. We were working at Microsoft. We left a very cushy job in a big company that was doing very well to join a risky startup to take our chances. Came here, very exciting for the first few months of the year, I would say. And then it all kind of just fell apart, right? And San Francisco was a ghost town at that time. You kind of walk around the city and all these kind of boards and companies that are just no longer there anymore. So it was a very, kind of educational experience, and our own startup kind of slowly people start getting laid off and start getting smaller groups of people. And at some time you realize it's time to move on. This is not going to happen anymore, right? So it was a very personal experience. Again, we lived through it, and that I think really helped us. It formed our point of view that we have to build a business more than just something that's going to be a fad.
That had to be profitable. And had to be something that was sustaining. You know, a lot of people were now recording this at the tail end of 2018. There are people who've gone 10 years without seeing one of these downturns in the economy, who don't know what it's like, who haven't prepared themselves emotionally, haven't prepared themselves financially for this, who are going to be in for a world of pain. You had your foundation in that. I wonder why. Why, when you saw that this was possible, did you go and start a company? Why didn't you say, hey, you know what? My partner and I met when we were working at Microsoft in Seattle. Let's go back to Microsoft, beg for a job instead of starting another startup.
That's exactly kind of, that was a decision point for us. We thought, hey, let's go and not go back to Microsoft, but join Google, which was the next kind of Microsoft of that era. Everybody was joining that as a big company. It was going fast. But we said we have been through it. We have been through Microsoft. We learned a lot at Microsoft. It was a fantastic kind of educational experience for us. But we didn't want to kind of just go back and do that again. We had the freedom to go and start something on our own. And we really felt, we believed in mobile. And more than anything else, we really felt this was the next big thing. And if we got in well enough, I think we could do something big there. It just took way longer than we thought.
When you say you believed in mobile, for the most part, the mobile phone that was hot back then was a flip phone, right? You flip it open, you got the 9 buttons plus the pound and the star. You talked about Jamdat. They created games that would work on these little phones with no color. Let's not color the past. When you were looking at it back then, what did you see that made you say, this is my opportunity? You saw people do what? What did you imagine was going to happen in the next year or two and took longer?
Yeah, so what we felt was, just from those times, the devices like the Nokia 7210 had come out, which is the first device which actually allowed you to write in with Java, J2ME, LitP kind of programming profile, build games and apps that run on a phone. And that just excited us. Now you could build apps which doesn't have to be installed on a PC. You could carry them in your phone. And the whole spectrum of what you could do. So we actually, when we started out, we wanted to build a platform that would enable mobile-to-mobile communication. That was like app voice, not like phone or calls, but you could actually have apps communicating from one device to another device. That was our big idea.
Like what? Give me a use case of what you thought you were going to get. You didn't have one?
Like multiplayer games. Like if you want to play chess with somebody else, you need some server software running on the cloud somewhere. And at that time, the cloud was not really a word out there. We need to have a server running hosted somewhere, which would allow you to communicate and do that. And you knew there are a lot of kind of technical problems, like the very low bandwidth connections. Connections keep on dropping off. So there are a lot of work you have to do at the server level to enable kind of great kind of communication between.
And you said, we're going to be the back end. We're going to empower that. If Andrew has an idea for a chess game that people can compete head to head on, good on him. We'll power that. If someone else has an idea for a shoot 'em up game, good on them. We're going to power that. This is the future, mobile to mobile. You launch your company 2002, as I said. What is the first version that you came out with?
So we found out very soon that it's very hard to sell a platform. So we went to gaming conferences, GDC and other events, and try to have people buy into it. First, there was no kind of need for a multiplayer game because people were still thinking about single player games at that time. Even they were a novelty at that point. So we actually started building our own sample games and multiplayer games. And we built there's a game called Spades, which is a card game that we built out.
Yep.
Just a single player version. And that became very popular. And it was a top selling game on like Sprint and a couple of other kind of operators. And that allowed us to see first dollar coming in into our company. And that was very exciting for us. So then we said, okay, there's something here. There's some way to kind of make a business out here. How do we improve that? So the multiplayer portion took a bit of a back seat for us as we started building more and more kind of these apps and games that would actually generate some revenue to kind of bootstrap the company. And then kind of it grew slowly from there. And at some point, I think when iPhone and kind of Android and these started coming out, at that time, we stepped back and we realized that the mobile gaming and app business was a Hollywood business model. If you got that one hit, you had it made. Great, lots of money coming in for a certain amount of time. And we had some hits as well. Like you mentioned, the Dummies app and some of the other apps we did. One of those was actually a top-selling app on the App Store in 2008.
What was the top-selling app?
I think Spanish for Dummies.
That happened later on. Let me stick with the beginning. In the beginning, to get on a phone, you had to go and make a deal with Motorola and get them to say yes to being on the phone. And so before you had any games, were you able to get partnerships with these handset makers?
Yes. So not just handset maker. You have to work with carriers and handset makers. So you have to go and find the world, try to get a deal with AT&T and Sprint.
And you did both of that. Do you remember when you got your first carrier and handset deal?
It was Nextel, and we got, I think, one or two apps. There was a cricket game, funnily enough, that we put out there, and then there was a space game that we put out there. And through an aggregator, there was a company whom we met at one of the trade shows who was aggregating content for these operators. So we are a company called Cellmania. So we worked with them, and they published our first title on Nextel.
Okay. And the advantage for Nextel was a carrier like AT&T. They were charging monthly for these games. And then the extra cost was getting hidden in the phone bill. So your phone bill would go from $100 to $102 a month or whatever. And you'd have this extra game and they'd have the extra revenue.
So it's more than one-time revenue though, most of them, not monthly. It's somewhere monthly later on. But it's just like you download the app for $2 and it's on your phone and you can play it as long as you want.
Yeah. Okay. So you were starting to make headway. At that point, were you able to make enough money to support yourselves?
Yeah, so we started kind of making some money through some of these apps and games that we were building out, and they started coming in. You have to kind of really go and get in front of the carriers, show why your games are unique, so they would feature you. If you got featured, you got lots of downloads and love. So we started getting some money out of that. It's still very, very kind of small amount of revenue. We went through a pretty rough patch at that time as entrepreneurs.
Give me an example. What was so rough about it? I don't want to brush over it and make it feel like you just instantly landed it where you are.
So I'll tell you, there was a kind of, I actually have a social security statement you get at the end of the year, which tells you how much social security income you have. So after getting like 100K plus kind of salary for the last few months before I left the company, when we started this company, I actually have a year, I have zero income in that one whole year. Actually, kind of. So we went from
over $100,000 to zero. How did you feed yourself?
I had saved up some money, had kind of things going. And when we were really we had moved from larger apartment to a studio apartment. So there were a lot of things we did personally to kind of cut our costs. And
when you say we, were you married? Did you have a family?
Okay, so my wife and I, we were both co-founders of the company. So we both were in this together.
And you both said, hey, you know what? We're going to go into a small... Now, when you go to a smaller apartment, you feel a little bit different about yourself, and then you feel a little more embarrassed about having people come over to see this new version of you?
I don't think we really cared about that. Both of us really didn't care about that at all. Yeah, absolutely. We had friends in both the older apartment, new apartment, and they all knew what we were trying to do. I think they were very kind of helpful and supportive. In fact, many of my friends were also in a similar, starting their own stuff. So we never felt any of that.
Okay. All right. So you're building these games. I interrupted you as you were starting to say it's a hit-based business and we knew that we couldn't be in that. Let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor and come back and ask you what you did once you realized this is a hit-based business. Okay. Here's the thing that just happened recently. Tumblr said they're not going to have porn on their platform. It's a thing that I brought up in past interviews. Tumblr kind of built itself up with a porn background. Most people don't see it. Here's the part that affects our audience. They're not in the porn business, but I saw this artist who said, I went to see which of my content was taken down or flagged by Tumblr. And it's like one guy showed a picture of a cat that had like runner's legs. And because the runner's legs had a little hair on them, somehow that triggered Tumblr software and Tumblr got flagged it. And I'm sure that for many people, their sites are going to be impacted, either completely put down or aspects of it will get taken down because Tumblr is going to decide it's not a good fit. So what does this have to do with my first sponsor, a company called HostGator? There are now a lot of companies that are in the builder space. They will make it super easy for anyone to build a website. You pay them monthly. You get your website. It's super easy to build. Fantastic. Here's the problem. You and your business are now at the whim of them. If they decide that they want to be aggressive about a certain type of content, you could get taken down. And it's not like you can take your whole site and move it to a different hosting provider because if you build on one of those builders, you're locked into their software. That's why I like building my websites on WordPress. If I don't like the hosting company, I take my WordPress website and I move it to another company. I don't like them, I move it again, I move it again, I move it again. There's nobody who can stop me. Same thing for you. If you're building a business on someone else's platform, you're really hurting yourself. Build it on a platform that you can take with you. And HostGator will work with WordPress and Magento and all these open source platforms. If you want to do a shopping site, they even have WooCommerce. Of course they do. And frankly, they're a site that's been around forever and doesn't charge a lot of money. So you know you could count on them to continue and you know that you're not going to have to pay a bunch of money to run your website. Do what I did when I started a new business. I went to HostGator. In fact, I went to HostGator.com/Mixergy because they gave me the lowest possible price. If you go to HostGator.com/Mixergy right now, you get a super low price. It'll be easy for you to get started. Build up as many websites as you want for one reasonable price. Super reasonable is not right. It's actually unreasonably low. And if you're ever unhappy, you can move it. HostGator.com/Mixergy. Oh, and I'm so sorry to the people who are on Tumblr who are needlessly getting flagged. That's another problem. Tumblr stopped evolving a long time ago. You build on someone else's platform, they stop evolving, your whole site stops growing. Okay, so coming back to this story, away from the ad, you realize that these game businesses were hit or miss. What did you do next?
So next, right around that time, mobile started taking off. That's when the iPhone, Android had come out, and people were starting to really use the devices. And we really felt shopping on mobile is going to be a big thing. I remember creating a demo, going to a large retailer and showing them a demo of a shopping experience on that site. I still remember the president of the company saying, shopping on this thing, I don't think that's going to be a thing. But he was nice enough to introduce me to some of his technology folks as well, and we started working with them. It worked out as a good partnership. But that was the really early days for us, and we realized as a startup, since we did not want to be in the the hits business and the games business, we wanted to really do enterprise sales. We wanted to go and get a few customers. And our focus was, let's go find some good customers, large customers who have real problems when it comes to mobile and mobile commerce, and see how we can help them because we have the right expertise. We've been using the space for many years now. We understand the challenges of delivering a great experience on mobile devices, and we have built a platform that is helping us.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you because I'm excited about this. This is the pivotal decision. I'm wondering why commerce. It wasn't obvious back then that commerce was going to be a thing. It's a pain for people to type in their credit card information using their thumbs, and that's the way we had to do it back then. Screens are too small to really evaluate. It feels like more of a move experience as opposed to spend time, focus on it. There was content. You could have created a content publishing platform. Why didn't you go for content? Why didn't you go for your own e-commerce site? Why do you want to do this?
Yeah, so the two reasons for that. One is if you're building your own content, just publishing content on mobile is a relatively easier problem. Enabling commerce and transaction is a hard problem. And we wanted to make sure we are solving a hard problem because that gives us some sort of defensibility. It allowed us to leverage our expertise and in mobile and platforms and scalable server platform for these experiences. So it was a harder problem to solve, and that's why we jumped onto it. And we wanted to have a problem that had large customer base, so large companies who are interested in it. So we realized that if we try to go down and try to sell target like small mom and pop shops and try to build something that can be used by SMBs, we would not be able to invest in the marketing and everything else that's needed to get scaled. But if you can get a few large customers, they have the funds and the budgets that they can fund your development and grow the company. So that strategy worked out well. In the first few customers we had were all large top 500 retailers. And we only used to get a few large customers as our clients every year. It's not that we are adding on hundreds of customers every year, but they were all very big. So what happened was, and that they helped us focus our platform evolution as well, because now we were seeing real problems that they were facing that we had to address in our platform, which would obviously apply. If I'm solving the problem for a top 10, top 20 retailer, that same problem is going to be faced by every other retailer down the line. It's just that the bigger guys tend to be slightly ahead of the curve.
So you're saying, look, it's a tough problem. Other people aren't going to get in on it. And if we can find a big client, they'll pay us essentially a consulting fee to create something almost custom for them. But whatever we create for them, because it's not exactly a consulting experience, we get to take and build into our platform that we bring to other customers. That was the thinking. How did you get the first client to convince you? I know you told, you talked to our producer, Brian Benson, about it. I'd love for you to talk about how you convinced them to work with someone new.
So the one large retailer, again, I won't go into names now, but very, very well-known retailer. We had to show it to them. We had to basically, the goal there is they understand the problem as well. We, when we went for the first kind of meeting, they say, okay, we heard you talk in a trade show, you're interested in mobile commerce, come and tell us what you have. And we understood their problems. We went overboard. The team that we had, we actually created a whole fully functional mobile version of their site, and we showed it to them. It's obviously a gamble. They might have just said, oh, great, thank you, but no thanks. But when they saw what we had brought to them, and then they started asking questions, and we had the head of technology, the head of IT, all the kind of the key people sitting there, they started asking questions, how do you do this, how do you do that, and kind of how do you solve this problem, how do you care of security, and all that. We had the right answers, and we have taken the right course. So this exercise of kind of going overboard in that we need to kind of impress them and to show them that we know our stuff is what allowed them to kind of give us a chance and try us out. Because mostly when it comes to these kind of initial pitch meetings and you're trying to convince somebody, either the guy on the other side will go for, it's a trusted, some well-known company, I know what they've done, so I can trust them with my business, because I'm a billion-dollar business, I can't just give it to anybody else. But when it's a new problem which bigger guys are not attacking right now, then it's only your credibility that will kind of win you. It's nothing else that will kind of make the sale, because you have to show to them that you know their problems and you can have a solution for them and you can do it.
So it's, you built it for them. You told our producer, here's a quote I highlighted for myself in my notes. You always have to do more than you think you should. They expected just a quick page. You basically created the site. Was it fully working?
Most of it. We could actually show them browsing on their site and show them how you do a transaction on the site. And they were impressed because we did not ask them for anything. We just did from the outside. And that's kind of a key part of the solution, because they did not want to go and do a major IT project internally to kind of create a mobile experience. So when they saw, we could do this from outside by kind of grabbing the data from their site and kind of rendering it in the right kind of mobile optimized format for different devices. And we knew how to kind of handle kind of from a security and transaction perspective. That's what helped us kind of.
How did you know all those issues? You weren't in the e-commerce space. Did you do any research that allowed you to know what problems they were going to consider?
So we have been in mobile for a very long time. So we know the problems that are specific on the mobile side of things, right? How to present that. And we also knew what you're trying to shop on mobile, what kind of challenges you can. We've already built shopping-related demos before that as well. And so we understood kind of shopping cart problems and kind of rendering problems, these kind of things that you would have in a mobile commerce thing. So we had a very good idea of the space.
Okay. And then they started asking you questions. Anything that helps shape the product based on what they said?
No, absolutely. I think what we kind of understood from them were their unique requirements as well. Like they were a multi-brand site. They had multiple kind of other kind of requirements that are specific that we had not initially thought through. But we could give them convincing answers on the fly. And I think that was key as well. I think as an entrepreneur, a lot of companies out there which kind of just go build a product and then they try to kind of find somebody to buy it. We had built a framework and built a platform. What we were able to convince them was that this is something that can meet their needs, but wherever there are gaps, we always had credible answers to what they kind of how we'll get to what they exactly wanted. We may not have everything right up front, right? And that is that trust building is that sales process is basically a trust building exercise. If you can establish on their trust, like you guys know what they're doing and they can solve the problem, then they move to the next stage. And that's how we were able to do that. I think that to me is key.
How did you even get in the right into the office with them?
This was basically, I was at a trade show. I was speaking in a panel and somebody from the company was there. And he reached out to me afterward and he said, you seem to be the only person on the panel who knew what he was talking about. Can we talk to you? So I don't know what I said at that panel, but whatever it was kind of had an effect. So that got us the invite.
You know, one of the things I like to do is go to the Internet Archive and see what the website of my guests look like. I went to Scava. Scava.com didn't really start as Scava.com as we know now for a while.
It started, yeah.
What was the website?
Scava.net.
Scour?
It's Scava.net.
Oh, Scava.net. What does Scava mean?
So Scava is S-K-A-V-A. So my name is Arishali, that's a A-A. And my wife and co-founder was Sudha K. Varadarajan. So we took our initials. We wanted something short, and we just kind of munched it together, and it came up as something as easy to kind of remember.
You know, I put your name into another tool that I like to use is Crunchbase. And Crunchbase listed all these dummies books. At what point did you create the dummies books? The apps for the dummies book.
Yeah, so those were kind of earlier on, I think sometime in 2007, 2008, kind of when we were still in the mobile games and apps business. That's when we got a bunch of licenses as well from we partnered with Wiley Publishing, which had the dummies brand name. And we actually partnered with all the companies, USA Today and some other companies as well. And we helped them kind of with the mobile apps and games that they were, basically they wanted to take their kind of licensed content and IP, and they wanted to create a mobile experience around that. So this was our again, what I call the Scala 1.0 business model, where we're building apps and games for licensed kind of content.
So this was actually what I was mentioning earlier. You did have a publishing platform. You did have publishing clients. It's just that business wasn't as big.
It wasn't really a publishing platform, as we clarified. It was basically, you know, we were using our mobile apps technology that we had built to build mobile applications. We were using it to create kind of interactive experiences and games and puzzles on top of that technology platform.
So it was more than just, it just happens to be that Basic French for Dummies is in iTunes, Basic Italian, Basic German, Basic Japanese, et cetera. That just happens to be what Crunchbase has, but you're saying there was way more than that.
Yeah, exactly. The technology was kind of broader than that. And we had built a platform that could allow you to build apps that would run on kind of iOS as well as Android and some other platforms as well. So we did a lot of general purpose mobile stuff that we pretty much kind of gave up on once we started working with large retailers, and we found that was a much better kind of business model and a kind of something more tangible for us to kind of focus on.
Oh, look at this. I do see it now. There is, you know, it's hard for me to tell which is you and which are company names that sound like you, but it was a bunch of different apps that you guys were doing.
Yeah.
Got it.
That's
okay.
True. You've done a lot of crazy stuff at that time.
Okay. So you're experimenting. Was e-commerce just one of these experiments? You saying, you know what? The other things seem right. They didn't work out. We're going to keep trying until we find the thing that works.
So I think the mobile apps and games was a good business model, but not our cup of tea. That was not something we wanted to kind of focus on. There have been a lot of other successful kind of mobile publishers and game publishers and app developers have done a phenomenal job of that. We wanted to really kind of go back to our root of building great platforms rather than building great kind of consumer-facing kind of solutions, right? So that is where we kind of focused on the enterprise mobile commerce capability. And once we got the first few customers and kind of we helped them launch their kind of mobile sites in public, that was phenomenal. Kind of once we got the first two wins, that allowed us to focus more. And it kind of snowballed from there. And I think our strategy of kind of going after really big names, big customers worked out, because once you got the first couple of them, it became very easy to go to other retailers and say, you know what, these brands are using us. You also have this pain point. We can help you get there. And that kind of became our sales strategy. We would go to every trade show, shop.org and other kind of well-known internet kind of e-commerce trade shows. I still remember shop.org, kind of the very first time I went to a single man show. I went, set up the whole booth there, waiting there to kind of meet prospective customers and all. We've come a long way now. We have a massive booth now, a whole team that goes out to attend these shows. But I still remember those early days where it was a one-man show sitting in the trade show and kind of hoping to meet some large retailers and convincing them to use our technology.
Did you actually get a customer that way? Did a customer come to you because you were sitting at... They did?
We did. So basically, this, if you are at the right show, they are like shop.org is really used to be the best show for internet and e-commerce. And every retailer and other company would come there to scout for new technologies and new vendors. So you have every kind of possible vendor out there. We tried to set up meetings in advance before the show, so we would already have a bunch of meetings lined up, but they would be completely kind of friendly to meetings as well, people you run into, and they'll find out, and then they could turn out into a deal later on.
Who were the big players at the time? Was Magento around at the time? Was OS Commerce around at the time, and they just weren't very mobile friendly?
That's absolutely right. So the big e-commerce players at that time was Oracle ATG, SAP Hybris, Demandware, which is now Salesforce Commerce, Magento. So there are a lot of these well-established e-commerce players in the market. And everybody we talked to, every customer that we got, was using one of these platforms. And the reason kind of they wanted to still work with us was they realized that because of the technology limitation, most of these platforms tended to be kind of monolithic systems. They had armies of developers kind of maintaining them. And these are platforms which were built, their biggest technology challenge used to be IE6 will upgrade from version 6.0 to 7.0, and they had to worry about that. But imagine from a platform that is built for that kind of a form factor and device, and now you have thousands of devices with different form factors, screen sizes, having to render on those kind of platforms, it is not something those platforms are built for. So both of these platforms eventually kind of caught up and started kind of providing mobile capabilities. But we had to, our pitch to retailers was, you will wait for many years to kind of really start doing it on your main platform. In that time, if a shopper comes to your site, has a bad experience and goes off to Amazon, they're not coming back to your site on the mobile device. They may still be loyal shoppers to you in physical retail or desktop, but mentally they'll associate that on a mobile phone, I have to go somewhere else. And you don't want to lose that shopper. And that was a big kind of driver for many of these retailers to jump onto and not wait for the existing platform to build mobile capabilities, because they did not want to lose those consumers. And this proved very important, because adoption of mobile was much faster than anybody kind of predicted. I think within the first few years, we were powering almost 50% of the traffic used to be coming from our mobile powered site versus their existing desktop site. So that was a huge kind of milestone for us, and kind of a big rationale for why retailers needed to adopt mobile very quickly.
All right, I'll talk about my second sponsor and then get back into what you did to keep getting customers. And then what advice do you have for anyone who's selling to bigger businesses? But my second sponsor is TopTal. And there's a guest that I had on Mixergy to teach a masterclass, the founder of Tatango. This dude used to listen to my interviews, Derek did. He's now growing so much. I'm now listening to his ads on other podcasts. Basically what Tatango does, it's a kind of a funny name, but they do text message marketing software, the kind of stuff most people do via email, but it's done via text messages, and he keeps you compliant. Tons of customers now, doing really well. And the thing that stood out for me as I was listening to an ad about his company on someone else's podcast was, why isn't he advertising with us, number one? And number two, about how when he was smaller, he had a CTO who needed to hire developers, and they needed to grow because they wanted to really get big. And so he was saying, well, how do we hire developers? And he did the usual thing. He put ads up on the internet. He would do 20 to 30 interviews. He'd wait for the CTO's time to get on calls with people. And it was just a waste, and it didn't work, and it wasn't productive. But that's what most people do, and some people get much more efficient than Tatango did. But Derek said, you know what? I know Andrew. I'm listening to his episodes a lot. I'm a fan of his stuff. Just give this TopTal thing that he keeps advertising a shot. And so he got to TopTal. He talked to them, and immediately TopTal set, not him, but his CTO up with two people to interview. The CTO thought they could hire either one, but they picked one of them that they felt best about. And that I actually see how much they paid. It's not outrageous, but I probably should keep it private. And within a short period of time, Derek's CTO said, you know what? This guy's so good. He could be our CTO. He could be our CTO. And they continue to work, no more working to try to find new developers. Instead, they got to work on their software and finding new customers. They ended up hiring more people from TopTal. If you're out there listening to me, do what Derek Johnson and so many other people who've heard my voice did. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. They're going to give you a big, big, big offer, which is 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period. There are a lot of details. Actually, it's pretty short. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. You'll see nothing hidden there. Super easy to work with them. T-O-P-T-A-L. Top is on top of your head. Tal is in talent. toptal.com/Mixergy. All right. You told Brian, and I kind of highlighted this with skepticism, you told him retail is a close-knit community. If you get a good client, you do well for them, they're going to start to talk about them. Is this really a space where there's a lot of, like, where people are recommending Scava and talking about it?
Well, absolutely. So I think retail in particular, I think many other industries are probably like that. But we have had all of our growth has been organic in the sense that we got some purely customers. We did some really good job for them. They acted as our kind of references for a few other customers down the line.
And were you ask them to be a reference, or do they just they don't naturally call up their friend and say, hey, guess what we're using? It's a great piece of software. What do they do? How does it work?
That also happens. I mean, what happens is it's a very kind of close-knit community that people leave their jobs and go to another retailer. And that happens all the time. And what will happen is when they go to a new job, sometimes they'll call back their previous job and say, hey, we are looking for a solution for mobile. What are you guys using? Because you're going to make a bigger company. You've already tried out somebody. So that definitely happens. You've gotten kind of inbound from people who have left and might kind of and taken the messages kind of to the new company. We have had people who have hired us at multiple companies. They were our clients at one company, and then somebody went to a different company and they gave us a call. Hey, they have the same problem. Can you come and help us as well? So this has worked very well for us. And this is something I would say, again, from a sales strategy perspective, it's very important that obviously you do a great job for your customers, so they're happy with what you've done. It's very important that you build relationships from a sales perspective, and not just with the key decision makers. And what I learned was you always want to do have a great relationship with number one, at the number two and number three people at each company as well, because at some point down the line the number one person is going to move out somewhere else and the number two person becomes the head out there. So building those relationships really helped us and kind of grow organically.
How? What's your process for building the relationships? Like, you and I are going to talk, we have a great conversation now, conversation will end in a few minutes, and then we may never talk to each other again. As much as I like you, as much as I like so many of my guests, I feel like there's no easy way to continue a conversation and then build up that relationship. What did you do?
So in a client kind of relationship, it's very different. Because you
what if they're not clients?
If they're not clients, so what we used to do was hold even the Scala Summit we did every year, where you call both clients and potential clients and kind of have them over in the Bay Area. Kind of, we took them to Napa once. We had another event. So just kind of let them know what we are doing, kind of what our future roadmap looks like, get their inputs as well. So these kind of events work with these kind of parties and kind of other social events as well. But I would say the biggest kind of, again, the what helped us build the relationship was over the course of a 1 year kind of engagement with them, going to meeting them regularly, again, doing a great job, and things would oftentimes not go well, right? I mean, things would not work out, something is not being delivered on time, they would escalate. Being able to kind of reassure them and fix and make corrections is what they appreciated. So it's not all, things will always go on as planned, but when things do go south, can you and your team, it's not just about you, right? You have the whole team which is engaging with the client. Can they step up? Can they get things done and deliver results for them? And when that happens, you find out that you have relationships at multiple levels, not just me talking to the VP of e-commerce, somebody else senior out there. It's also my delivery manager, my program manager, working with their director of IT, their program manager, and those relationships also help down the line. So it's relationships at all levels that have to be kind of maintained and nurtured, and they pay off, I think, more effectively than any other kind of marketing campaign you can do.
I mentioned that Barnes & Noble was a client of yours largely because they've been on the site for a long time. Doesn't Barnes & Noble, though, want to build their own software? I mean, this is a key part of their business today. The stores are closing down. The software is the thing. If they're not good at building their own software, what are they then? Good at picking books?
Good point. So I think this not just with Barnes & Noble. So I'll talk more broadly. So many of our customers are in the same boat, where it's not about even building software. It is like, I have to give a great experience to my consumers so they can come and shop on whatever I'm selling, right? When it comes to doing that, they only have two options. One, they use software that's available, or they build on their own. And this is where the trade-off tends to be. I mean, companies who are kind of born and kind of brought up online, like Amazon.com, they've all been built on top of software. That's kind of their DNA, and that's what they have done very well. Companies which are not kind of born and brought online, they have to figure out a way, how do they get that talent, how do they get that kind of asset. If you're really big, like Walmart, they are famous for acquiring large kind of e-commerce companies and growing that way. But not everybody is a Walmart. So they, and when you move down kind of the top few kind of retailers, it's very hard for them to kind of be able to build at scale, get the kind of talent that they need. That's when these partnerships come into play. What they try to do is work with Silicon Valley companies where they can get that talent, that mindshare. They understand that there's a cost to kind of buying companies and to kind of just to acquire the talent or the technology and own it versus kind of renting it from those companies and kind of having the right partners. And that's where the relationships are key. It's the business objective that has to be met. Technology is purely incidental. They are business.
The thing that's standing out for me is, as you're saying that, I'm looking at the reviews on the iTunes App Store. It's 1.8 out of 5. And so if they're hiring someone to build their app, isn't that what you guys built?
So again, what we enable them to do is kind of create the shopping experiences on those devices. There are a lot of things that go into when you trade off on a project like that, right? So there is an app review, there is a different types of solutions that we are doing for them. So when we are powering an experience for them, right, there's a web experience, a mobile experience, a mobile web experience where a lot of transaction actually takes place. Where the reviews itself or the design of the app itself, you work closely with the client to kind of make sure it meets what their needs are. There are always trade-offs. You will see some of the properties, some of the apps may not be doing as well as something else. And a lot of the reasons for those kind of reviews are could be certain products are not available, certain things are not, or transactions are not working. So there are sometimes bona fide reasons why those things may not be working as well as they're expected to. The really interesting part is for example, you just went to Black Friday. We had multiple clients on Black Friday. We had 100% kind of uptime, no outages at that time, which is absolutely key.
Because you're hosting the content.
All those sites are running on us. So from a business perspective, what is key to all our retailers is how much revenue they're generating on the platform. Where they prioritize and kind of where we work with them very closely is, are we help making sure that your transactional site is not going down, where people are able to buy a quick kind of things when they need to, or especially during a critical period like Black Friday. That's where you get kind of all our customers happy from us. So we look at our customers as giving us our priorities and making sure that we have the right capabilities in our platform to do that. Now, whether a particular app or particular solution is what consumers may give feedback, they may not like the site, they may not like the app. Like we have other customers who have had the top rated kind of sites and app as well in other reviews as well. So we have had both kind of wins and kind of things that may not have gone very well. But our metric, our criteria is not what the consumer is telling us, it's what our customer is telling us. And we want to make sure we are delivering to what they are looking for. I think from that metric, we have given an outstanding Black Friday of this year. And over the past few years as well, the holiday season has been flawless. That's how our customers...
When I look at the reviews, it does seem like it won't let me sign in. Everything takes forever to load. It's stuff like that that comes up. I don't see a lot of people saying the book that I want is not available. Timeout, 404, crash, that type of thing is what I'm seeing. Yeah. On iOS, yeah, so on Android, it's a different story. People are excited about it and the ratings are high, but it feels like there's some issues with the software and that's surprising.
No, I mean, that happens. I mean, we have had apps, and there's a reason why those particular apps may not be that highly rated. But again, to me, the issue is not around kind of are we meeting our customer's needs? And if the customer wants us to kind of prioritize, focus on that, we'll be doing that. If the customer wants to focus on the commerce side where they're getting most of their transaction and revenue for, we'll be doing that as well. So we work with the customers, understand what their priorities are, and make sure that that's being met. As I said, our customers are our clients, and we are trying to make sure that they are happy with what they need. If they want us to kind of focus and build a different app, we will happily do that for them.
One of the things that I noticed was that you went for about 5-6 years of pain from 2002 to 2008, roughly, when the iPhone App Store came out and soon after Android. Now it's called Play, but it was called what? The App Store there too. Why did you continue with the business considering all the pain, considering the frustrations?
There were a lot of points where we thought, do we need to continue with this, right? And one of the things I think a lot of entrepreneurs get into is, again, I have a lot of time that being an entrepreneur is roughly a 10-year journey if you're trying to build anything which is of value, right? You have to struggle your way through. You have to kind of stay persistent. If you fundamentally believe that the space is real, the opportunity is real, the timing of it may be off. But if you know that this is going to really take off, then you have to stay persistent. And I think that was what kept us going. We knew this is not, we could see that. I mean, it's obvious to us that this is going to be big.
That mobile was going to be big. You weren't sure exactly what. Was it going to be mobile games? Was it going to be mobile books? Was it going to be something? You weren't sure. You just said mobile is going to be big. It's got to be.
Exactly. And it's going to be
were you a mobile person? Were you someone who had like a phone that you were doing more on than most people? Did you have a Palm Pilot that gave you an insight? What was it that you did that said to you, this has got to be the future of everyone?
I was using one of the first BlackBerries that came out for email and communicating, for example. We were working with a lot of mobile devices at that even early on in the previous company, you were doing some mobile stuff as well. The transformative power of kind of how it kind of set you free, you could be anywhere and you could be transacting, you could be interacting. And that was a no-brainer. So that is what we kind of felt very excited about. And we said this has to kind of take off in a big way at some point of time. It just took longer than we thought. I mean, every trade show we went, we used to say, next year is going to be the year of the mobile. And that, I remember the CTI Wireless show, that was a big show in the mobile industry. Every year people would talk about next year is the year of the mobile. And it just turned out to be a few more years down the line than everybody thought.
I feel like it finally now this year became a big thing. I forget the Adobe analytics data on mobile, but it's a huge amount of money now being spent on mobile. I wish I had the data in my fingertips right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's been increasing. I mean, every year. I think it's just been going up every year. Since kind of the iPhone Android thing kind of came there, it's just been growing by leaps and bounds. And everybody is now heavily invested in kind of mobile first, mobile only kind of business models and business plans.
Yeah, and I think that some of the problems that we used to have been overcome. We're getting more used to doing things on phone, but also phones are getting smarter at helping us. Like, I don't have to type in my credit card information anymore. I just double tap the side of my screen and now I can pay. I buy, I'm on Overcast. If you guys listen on Overcast, you should subscribe to Mixergy on there. And they're so good at selling ads to me. All I have to do is hit the phone and then boom, I buy it. It's actually so much easier to buy using Apple Pay on my phone than when I go to buy an ad from Overcast. We're talking about like $1,000, $1,500 for an ad. They say, do you want to use Apple Pay? I hit Apple Pay, yes. It says, okay, double click the side of your phone. So I'm on my computer. I just go to my phone, which is smart enough to make the interaction. I double tap the side, boom, I paid. It's that much easier on mobile now than desktop. The desktop has to rely on mobile. You really were prescient. I think back on like when you were a kid programming can you tell people about that first game that you programmed to see how far you've come?
Oh, absolutely. So the very first game, I learned kind of GW Basic by reading a magazine, which had an article on programming. And when we first got a PC in our school in the 8th grade, I was kind of dying to kind of try it out. So the first game I wrote was, I rendered like a little rocket kind of shape on the screen that would just move up the screen. And there were two lines. And you had to tap the space bar as soon as the rocket reached in between those two lines.
Yeah.
And captured that, and that would be it.
And that was the beginning of you getting started with mobile games, with computer games.
I mean, the very first program I wrote was a game, basically.
Wow. You're still at Scava?
Yeah.
Why did you sell if you're still at the company? Why did you decide to sell?
So a couple of reasons. I think we had realized that mobile commerce had reached kind of a logical, kind of we were the number one kind of Forrester kind of rated leader in mobile commerce at that point of time. And we also realized that eventually the e-commerce players would catch up. They would start putting their big players with big market share. So we knew that to compete to the next level and kind of not kind of just again go downhill kind of once the market has kind of gone. So we had kind of had a good product to market fit for that window of time when mobile commerce was big and on its own. People, there was a play for a company to just focus on that. But we knew this was out there kind of go, we had to kind of grow beyond that. So we needed to grow much bigger. That meant either kind of taking a large amount of funding and trying to kind of pivot to a much bigger space. And exit just made a lot of sense and it kind of happened organically as well. We kind of had a couple of companies got interested in us at that time. And it just made a lot of sense because it gave us, not just from personally as entrepreneurs, kind of, you know, have kind of an exit under your belt, kind of breathe a bit more easily and kind of say, yeah, this is kind of done and you can move on. More importantly, from a product and strategy perspective, being part of a much bigger kind of organization allowed us to kind of now set our sights higher. And that's what allowed us to kind of now we can go compete on a global scale. Prior to acquisition, we were kind of North America focused, kind of retail focused as industry. Post acquisition, we have kind of really taken on the big guys. We are now competing against all the big e-commerce vendors. We have pivoted from m-commerce to full e-commerce platform. And just this year, both Gartner ranked us in the Magic Quadrant as one of the kind of the players in that space, and IDC called us a major player. So that's a big milestone for us that now we are actually competing against Salesforce, IBM, SAP, Oracle, all the big guys. We believe we have the best kind of technology, most modern kind of technology for e-commerce to compete against them. But there's no way we could have done that just as being a small startup. You need scale at many different levels to kind of take on those fights.
Yeah, I see you in Gartner. As you're talking, I'm searching to see, like, what can I find about Gartner? Gartner 2018 says you guys are more visionary than Shopify, then SiteScore, then BigCommerce. And then they put you, I see their analysis of you. Even Gardner's peer review has very positive reviews of you. And I heard recently Infosys wants to sell the business. New leadership there, right?
Yeah, that's true. So we are looking.
How does that feel that they're publicly saying the last guy made a mistake buying this company and this other one, and we got to get rid of it by March or something? I forget what they said.
Yeah, so I think, again, I can't come in because it's a public company and these are kind of public statements, but it is just that we are exploring the best possible kind of strategic option for the company. We are still focused on our goal, which is have the best possible digital commerce platform out there and take it to as many customers as possible.
All right. For anyone who wants to check it out, it's at scava.com. And don't you also personally blog? I did a bunch of research on you. I found a bunch of articles. Do you blog any at all, or is this from other people?
Yeah, so basically, I work with the marketing team to publish occasional kind of posts out there. I use Twitter and LinkedIn and kind of our own blog to kind of more from a professional point of view, not personally.
All right. So Scava, not .net anymore. It's now scava.com. Go check them out there. And I want to thank my two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first will host your website, right? It's called hostgator.com/Mixergy. The second will help you find your next phenomenal developer. Just like so many other people who've listened, you should go check them out at toptal.com/Mixergy. And finally, if you have a smart speaker somewhere, yell at it. Say, hey, whatever it is that you've got it, Google. I won't say the other name, so I won't start calling them up. Say, hey, play Mixergy and let me know if it's working for you or not. If it's not, maybe we need to start like doing domaining or buy a bunch of variations of the name on these devices. I want to make sure that everyone can listen to Mixergy and the entrepreneurs that are on here. And I'm so proud to have you on here. Thanks so much for doing this interview with me.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
You bet. Bye. Bye, everyone.